We're talking with Calvin Parker, My Story, Calvin Parker, Pascagoula, The Closest Encounter, one of the most famous encounter stories of all time. And for 45 years, Calvin effectively dodged it, didn't want to talk about it. This book includes not only Calvin's very candid account of what happened on that night in October 1973, it includes a transcript of the secret tape that was recorded by the sheriff's office. It includes the full report that the Air Force prepared after interviewing the two guys who had the encounter. It has dozens and dozens of news clippings of the time, how that story spread all over the world, the different accounts and reports that were filed, and how much interest there was among the general public. It even has a comic book that was put out about the Pascagoula incident. And a lot more stuff, including reports by other witnesses. Yes, there were other confirming witnesses who saw some weird stuff on the same night in that same place. When we come back, Calvin Parker picks up the story. Calvin, we'll pick up the story in just a moment because there's so much still to cover. But I wanted to ask you one thing before we move on, and it's about how you were treated back then. Now, as you've already described, the town was sort of inundated by all these media folks, these reporters. They're bugging your employer. They're going to the sheriff's office. They're barging in on your families and trying to get this story. And they start looking into your background, trying to find anything about you or Charlie that would prove that you're lying, that you're making this story up. And it's I can't imagine what that was like, but there's an attitude that you see in these news clippings that's sort of what you'd call snark, in that they hear your accents and they figure, well, these are just two good old boys in Mississippi who were having a couple of beers while they're fishing and made this thing up. It's kind of an arrogance that permeates some of these stories, and it makes you into kind of a caricature, you know. Well, the only people who see UFOs are guys out in the middle of nowhere. You've dealt with that your whole life, right?
Ever since that happened, I've dealt with it. That's 45 years. And that's one reason I decided to write this book. Philip told me, he said, oh, they're still trying to change your stories, add to it, or make up stuff about you. Put your story in a book. That's your legacy. Then they can't change it. It's there. And he was right, and I'm glad I did it. But, yeah, they just dream up stuff to tell, talk about you, or to make the story more interesting. And it didn't really need to be more interesting. It was pretty interesting. If I'd been sat back listening to it, somebody telling it, I would have just took it all in. But I can understand.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I can understand, people that don't believe. The ones that believe in stuff like this do believe. The ones that don't. But you have this certain amount of people that's open-minded, and they're the ones that need to hear the truth and for everything to come back, because, you know, I think it's just public information they need to know. And I know the government probably withholds a lot of this stuff and all, and they shouldn't do it. I didn't. I'm not holding back. Once I decided to tell it, I tell it. It don't bother me. The way it is the way it is.
You know, the sheriff took it seriously, and so did the Air Force. I mean, you can tell what their reaction and their report that's included in the book. They took it serious. They weren't accusing you of making it up at all. And then Dr. J. Allen Hynek comes to see you, along with Dr. James Harder, these top-notch UFO investigators, and tell me how they reacted and how they questioned you.
Well, they came into it with a real open mind. I mean, they didn't say one way or another when they first got there. They took us, and they was down probably a couple of days after this happened and flew down on their own dime. I mean, nobody sent them. They just put their own money up to come down when they heard about it through the media. So they took us into a little room, and both of them talked to us, and then we told our stories. And Dr. Harder tried to hypnotize us. Well, he did actually hypnotize Charlie, and he got me hypnotized, and he had to bring me back out. And Dr. Hynek was sitting there during all this stuff. And by the time Dr. Hynek left, he said, there's no doubt in my mind that something happened to these men. Just what, I don't know. He said, but if they're acting, they need to be in Hollywood because they're just that good. And they left on that note right there. And I didn't have no way of keeping up with them. Like I say, back then, it wasn't computers or phones, cell phones. And I sure wasn't going to hand out my phone number to a bunch of people.
How long did this media thing go on for you guys? Was it days? Was it weeks?
Well, I could really say years, even right on up to now. But the real flood of the media went on for probably 3 months. I mean, it was every day. They was tracking you down. They was coming to where you were. And I was just so sick of it until you go out and try to work and make a living, and then you got a bunch of people with the press showing up wanting to take your picture and sit there and interview you and all. Well, that doesn't go over too good on a job. I lost a couple of jobs doing that. And finally, I got fed up with them. And I told one of them, I said, look, fella, I'm going to take that camera and run it up your butt if you don't get away from me and leave me alone. And the real thing about it, I wouldn't have mind if they could all got together in one spot, come in and just sit down and talk about it and ask sensible questions and got rid of them. But every time you give an interview, the interview that you gave would change. You'd get it on and then they'd make you out to be some kind of Star Wars character or something. And I just didn't like that. You know, how it is, tell it. I don't care if it's boring or if it's good or scary or not scary. The truth is the truth, regardless of how you lay it down. And that's the way they need to do it.
You say in the book, I mean, you reveal that you basically had a breakdown. And you had to get away. You got away from it.
I did. And I had went home. It's just me and my brother there that night. And I went to bed. And it had been a terrible day already. Like I say, I had some of them show up on the job that I was on and had to deal with that. So when I got home, I don't know what happened. I just broke out in sweats and shaking and just all kind of things happened. Well, my brother come in and he seen something was wrong. He said, I'm going to take you to the emergency room. I said, no, I don't want to go. He said, no. So we went to the emergency room that night. He did. I let him go ahead and take me because I knew something wasn't right. So when we got there, they must have been busy because they took us in there and they set us down. I filled out my paperwork, or he filled it out for me. And we sat there and they wouldn't see us. And the more I sat there, the more convulsions I went into. And finally, I told him, I said, I want you to leave because I don't want you going to jail with me because I'm fixing to tear this place up. And he said, no, don't do that. I said, you better get out the door. You'll be in jail. You won't be able to get me out. So when he walked out the door, and apparently he didn't leave. He just went out and sat in the car for a few minutes, take a break to get away. And I picked up the chair and I slammed it into a desk and that got their attention pretty good. And one of the doctors come out and he seen the shape that I was in, you know, after they tackled you and got you down. And I heard him tell them nurses, if anybody ever comes in and they in this kind of shape, you call me immediately. You call somebody out here right then to see them and don't put them off. So anyhow, he talked to me. He gave me a shot, I think, to settle me down and asked me to stay for a few days. He said, let me keep you safe up here. We'll check you in the hospital where nobody can see you, and you stay here a few days. I said, no, I got to get up and go to work in the morning. So that's about how it ended up. I took a shot. He wrote me a prescription for some kind of yellow-looking little pill. And I filled the prescription, but I never did take any of them. I just set them in the bathroom medicine cabinet and left them there.
You know, 1973, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I got up the next morning, went on back to work. I was better.
1973, not everyone in the country has heard about alien abduction experiences. That was such a still relatively new thing. There have been a couple of cases that's why the media horde showed up, because there was a lot of interest and those kinds of things, they were still kind of rare. We didn't have the, it wasn't as commonly known as it is now. At the time, did you, after you had this experience, did you start reading about these things? Did you start learning more about it? Were you curious about how other people had got through it?
I was. Now, after before the experience, I had no idea about anything like this. But after the experience, Charlie had invited me one time to go to a conference. Now, I didn't want to speak, but it sounded like a good free trip to me. So I went to Chicago with him, and I just set up kind of on it. I can't remember what talk show it was. It might have been Mike Douglas. So I just set up in there and visited for a little bit, and they really didn't ask me no questions. He kind of took all the questions, Charlie did. So after that, though, the main reason I went, Betty Hill was going to be on that show, and I wanted to see. I knew that Betty and Barney Hill had went through something, and I kind of wanted to believe her really bad, but I still didn't believe it until I talked to them, because anytime a mixed couple back in the 60s put yourself in a position to be in a public eye, stuff like that didn't go on. You didn't marry out of your race back in and tell everybody. So they just set themselves up for ridicule, I thought. And if she come out with a story like that, and it had to be something to it. So I got to talking with Betty, and I mean, she's got the kind of outgoing personality that just takes you in. And she invited me up to her house to spend a few days. So I left and went with her, and we got to visit, and I found out more about how she handled it and how it went. Of course, he was dead by then, so you know, I didn't get the chance to visit with her husband, but she was still there. And we went up to a site in the mountains where she used to claim she had contact. Now, I never seen nothing but a couple of shooting stars, but it was pretty and it was peaceful up there. So.
You got to meet Travis Walton, too, at some point, right?
I did. I met Travis. I met Travis on a couple of occasions, and we really just kind of visited a little bit. Not much. He probably don't even remember me. So, and then Bud Hopkins, I know he wasn't abducted, but he had this book out on missing time. And in the 90s, I had some missing time, so I wanted to go see Bud Hopkins. And I didn't want to go by myself because I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be seen where he was and have to go into a conference and speak. So I took a friend of mine, and he went in and found Bud Hopkins. He told him that I wanted to see him and talk to him. And Bud agreed. He said, well, y'all go to my motel room, and I'll be up there in an hour or so. And we did. We went to Bud's motel room, and that's when he asked me if he could hypnotize me. I explained to him what happened. So Bud wanted to hypnotize me, and I agreed to let him do that. And Buddy, it led into a wasp nest of stuff.
Yeah, I'll say. Had you ever had a even sort of a subconscious thought that maybe something like this had happened before, or talked to anybody in your family that hinted that maybe there was something else to it before you talked to Bud Hopkins?
Yeah, I had. I had thought about it. But it was in the back of my mind, and it was mostly my brother. When we were smaller, we used to share a room, and he woke me up one night and said there was somebody standing over me looking in my ear, and of course, I didn't believe him, and I thought he was just seeing ghosts because he was younger. We was both young then, but that was one of the indications, because I remembered that, and I remembered this feeling, the sense that somebody was there. And Bud kind of brought all this out. Now, he put a post-hypnotic suggestion that I wouldn't remember this until I got to where I could handle it. And actually, when Philip got the transcripts from from Bud, but they actually, Bud had passed away. He got the transcript from David Jacobs. So David wrote me a letter and asked if it would be all right to give them to Philip. I said, sure, anything Philip wants is fine. So he transcribed it all out, wrote it down. He made a copy of the original tape, put it on a CD, and sent it to me. Well, I still hadn't listened to it. And what I do, I listen as I remember what happens, and it's coming back vaguely to me, but a good deal of it's already come back. And as I remember what happens, I take the book and I read it just to see and what might have come out in hypnosis. And it kind of scary because I didn't even remember being hypnotized. When he told me I was I didn't think I was ever hypnotized. So when Philip told me he had the tape and I was hypnotized, I couldn't hardly believe it. But after reading it,
what comes out in that transcript from that session is that you had other encounters, that you had them through your whole life, right?
Yes, sir, it is. And the one to me that hits home was the day that brought on the whole event of me going to see Bud, the missing time deal. When I got up one morning, told my wife, I said, I'm going fishing. I'm going to run to the islands, fish for a little while. I'll be back before dark. So she fixed me a lunch, and I got in the boat, and it was probably, 45 minutes to the island where I was going. And I sat out there, and I remember it being around lunchtime, and I was thinking, well, I'm going to go ahead and eat my lunch, and I'll finish my fishing. If they don't start biting here in a minute, I'm fixing to go home. And next thing I knew, it was probably 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and that was 11 o'clock at eve that day. So I had a lot of time missing and a lot of explaining to do when I got home. And me saying, I don't know where I was. That don't go over good if you're married. You're supposed to be home at a certain time.
No, that doesn't work.
Because she had done made arrangements to call the Coast Guard and everything else. But by rule of thumb, we always talked about, give me a little time in case something happens. If you're going to call the Coast Guard, wait about 12 hours, because if I'm drowned, I'm drowned then anyway. And, so by rule of thumb, she hadn't called yet, but she was just before calling the Coast Guard to come get me. And I wish she had her. They might have found something out there that would have been helpful to me. But that's
Calvin,
part of the missing time.
Right. So you really wanted to talk to Bud Hopkins. I should mention, we're going to go into a break here now. There were other witnesses who saw the lights and the things that you and Charlie saw that night, right?
A bunch of witnesses. Matter of fact, the Coast Guard, a day or two before this, or after this, the Coast Guard was called out. There was two fishermen in a boat, and they seen something under the water that was kind of following them and all. And the Coast Guard went out and checked it. There was 6 people on this Coast Guard vessel. And the report of the original Coast Guard reports in the book also, where they took a stick and probed it. And then it just kind of disappeared and all. And that was surprising to me. That was the first I heard about it. But
yeah, we're talking with Calvin Parker about the Pascagoula, the closest encounter. We'll be back. I should mention we posted an article on the Coast website that has some photographs from that time period, 1973, and the likeness of the robotic creatures that came out and grabbed Charlie and Calvin. Calvin, have you ever seen those robotic things before? And as a corollary to that question, the other creature that was inside, you had called her a her. You have seen her before, right?
I have. And it's really hard to describe the facial features and all. I've seen pictures since I got into this of those some with some big eyes and all. This was nothing like that. This had little small eyes, and it did have facial features, a little split for a mouth, a little nose, and small ears. And they all kind of look human to me. Now, the big robotic creatures, I don't know. They were that army, I think, is what they are. I think they just kind of enforce or help enforce the younger ones, the doctor ones. Because this was doctors.
The female, I mean, you had the definite feeling that she was a female, and that once it occurs to you that you've had other encounters, that it's the same one that's been periodically intervening in your life the whole time you've been alive, right?
Well, I don't know if it's the same one or not, or they look the same. Now, on the 73 abduction, you know, she seemed real nice and real kind, as nice as what you can be if you're going to abduct somebody and throw them in, just say they'll break into your house and drag you out, throw you in a van, give you a physical. And that's about what happened. So, you know, she seemed nice to be an abductor. The one in the 90s where I was fishing, that weren't so nice. I'm not for sure if it was just two different ones with two different missions or two different types. They looked the same, but I don't believe it was the same one because there wasn't no heart there, period, at all.
In the transcript of the session you had with Bud Hopkins, there's a couple of funny lines where you're expressing what you'd like, how you'd like this to be handled, leave you the heck alone, except for you're not using the word heck. And then you describe a scene in which you throttle this female. You grab her by the throat. Do you think that happened, or that was something that you wished happened?
No, that happened. That actually happened. It was actually some blood exchanged in that deal. Again, they went back to examine. I feel like they had some kind of deal inserted in my nasal cavities and all to keep up track, or maybe up with my medicals or something. And she reached her finger all the way up through my nasal passage from the front and from the back down through my mouth and pulled it out. And it was blood just running all over me. And it hurt so bad. Now, I felt pain on this one, and it was so harsh that my adrenaline kicked in, and I was able to get a hold of her and just go to town on her there for a little bit. And actually, I wanted to kill her, and that was the feelings I had toward that one. They should have sedated me a little better, but I don't know how they stopped all of it, but, you know, I settled down after that, and I guess she did too, or it did. But the first one, I didn't get that feeling of violence or nothing with. You know, you'd start thinking, well, I'm going to grab her and take her out of the ship. I have something to show everybody, hang her head on the wall like I do a deer or something. So, but that calmed down, you know. It wasn't near violent like it was in the 90s.
You had a memory that bubbled to the surface about another thing that happened. I mean, there's already the story that your brother had told you he woke up and somebody was looking into your ear. And then you remembered something that happened in the woods where you're with your family, right? And you thought it was a ghost?
Yeah, I thought, no, I really didn't know if it was a ghost or what it was. But all through my life, it's been little bitty things that add up. Now, one thing that was kind of scared me is after this abduction in 73, my brother and my mother was at her house in Ellisville. They had a farm over there, and it was they had cattle and dogs, and she's straight up Bible thumper, you know. So something landed in the back of the field, and it started herding up the cattle back there. And it woke her up. The dogs woke her up. They went and looked at the back door. And she got scared. She kept saying, Calvin's not here. Calvin's not here. So I figured, you know, and I hadn't even talked to her about the abduction. She knew about it because of the media. But we hadn't sat down and talked about nothing. And she was afraid, I guess, afraid they was going to get her and my brother at the time. But I've never heard anybody in the family talk about seeing anything different than, you know, any kind of abductions or anything. Or they hadn't talked to me about it.
Let's take a call or two. We've got a caller in Lake Charles, Louisiana, named Gary, who has a story to share with us. Gary, what's on your mind?
Hello. How you guys doing?
All right.
I've been wanting to get on this show for so many years. I'm from Lake Charles, and I used to live in New Orleans. I was a professional guitarist, played in a lot of bands from New Orleans to Houston during those days. And I was traveling with my friend over Lake Pontchartrain, the southwest corner of the lake, going into New Orleans. It was about 7 p.m. the same night of your abduction, October 11th, 1973 there. And we were about 2 miles just west of the control tower at the Kenner Airport there. I don't think it's called that. It doesn't have that same name now, but back then it was the Kenner Airport. We saw just a huge ball of light appeared right in front of the off to our right as I'm driving. I was driving, but we saw a huge ball of light appear, and it hovered right in front of the control tower, and it looked like, well, I know it was hovering there, and it was checking out the control tower. Whoever was in that control tower must have been pretty well freaking out, because it had to have been within 500 feet or so from that control tower. And it did that for about maybe 10 seconds. And we were just astonished. And all of a sudden, that light broke up into two lights, and both as big as the first light had been. And one light stayed there and continued hovering there, looking at the control tower. And the other light zoomed off, and it buzzed a couple of the airplanes that were coming into the airport there that were landing. Just at an unbelievable, tremendous speed, this thing zoomed off. And my friend was, I was trying to watch the road here. We're going across a water basin there where the water's real, almost it feels like you're in the water there. It was part of I-10. I think the hurricane took that out a while back. But this other light that was hovering in front of the control tower did a quick shot. It went straight up into the sky, and it was gone. And I was thinking, well, shoot, I wanted to see more than that. And so I'm kind of straightening out my car here, fixing to go off the bridge there. And I was so excited. And my friend said, it's on your side now. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I looked, I had my window down, and to my left, about 30 or 40 feet, right directly to my left, here's this ball of light, stationary, hovering about 2 feet above the water, Lake Pontchartrain. I could see it as plain as day. If I'd had a football, I could have hit it with the football. And it wasn't moving, and it must have gone. It was traveling 1,000 miles an hour. Like I said, we were about 2 miles from where it left there to the control tower. Then it jumped next to my car. My friend, I lost contact with him at that point. I think he got pretty scared. And I was just looking at this thing, and the thing that I remember the most, it seemed like about 25, 30, 35 feet, totally round. It wasn't so bright that I couldn't look at it. In fact, I was looking directly at it. But I was looking below it at the water, that the little tiny wind-driven waves coming in off the lake there, and they were kind of splashing a foot or two above the lake there. And I was hoping, a wave would splash the underneath of this thing so I would know it was a solid object. And, of course, that did not happen. And it scared me because this thing, I remember saying, hey, you guys don't have to come any closer. Just stay where you are. And I was talking to it. I said something like, if you better pull your ship up, or you're going to get some Louisiana mud on the bottom of it, you know, and just being kind of spooked. And about that time, that went on for about, I would say, 45 seconds where it was off to the left of my car. And all the cars in front of me, we all had stopped, and there was about 4 cars in front of me, and we were all looking at it. But it was like right there next to me, the closest. Anyway, hey, it shot up. It went up real slow. To my relief, and it shot out in front of us. Now we're looking at it through our front windshield. We're all still parked. We're actually stopped on this throughway over the water, and that's not a good thing to do, you know.
But hey, Gary, this is a great story, but we only have a couple of minutes left here with Calvin on the program. Were you abducted that night?
No, but that's about the only thing that didn't happen. And this thing got out in front of us and did all kind of zigzags and maneuvers, and it was totally unbelievable, and it took off.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to ask Donna to get your contact info. The fact that it happened on the same night, that's pretty interesting information, and I'd like to get your contact info so we can pass it on to Calvin. But I thank you for calling and sharing your story. Going to get one more call in, Paul in New York. Hey, Paul, good morning.
Good morning. I had a quick question. Charles Hickson had made a claim that UFOs had basically been tracking him around the country. And I can remember Ray Stanford had invited him down to Texas and sort of used him as bait. And he said it was one of the few times that his organization, Project Starlight International, had been able to actually track an object. And it sort of confirmed Charlie Hickson's story. And I just had the question of whether he had ever talked to Charlie about his similar post-1973 experiences.
Oh, good question. Thank you, Paul. Calvin, does this ring a bell?
No, actually, Charlie and I, when I left Pascagoula, we seen very little of each other, with the exception of that one time that we went to Chicago together, and we never talked about, we never really just sat down and talked about what happened. But I heard from Ray Stanford about this the other night, and he was telling me, and it was kind of amazing to me that and I believe it. I think they might have been tracking him all along.
What about you? Have you had ongoing experiences, or is it leaving you alone?
Well, it's hard to say. I fish a lot at night, and one night I feel like the last caller, the one before last that you had, had seen the ball of light. I had a bunch of people in the boat. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and this big ball of light, and I marked it up as marsh gas, but it come exploding toward the boat like that. It looked like it was going to run into us. We made a quick turn and dodged it barely, and it went right by us. But, you know, other than that, not really, not nothing. But it was a lot of witnesses on there that night that seen that. But I marked that up as marsh gas because that happens out here pretty regular.
You and Charlie sort of went your separate ways. Is that you just didn't really want to deal with it anymore, and that was one way to put it aside, is not to talk to him?
Well, that was the biggest thing. I knew Charlie was going to keep it. He was obsessed with it at this time, and he was going to keep it in the press, and he was going to keep doing these conferences and all that. So the only thing I knew to do to get away from it was separate myself from him. And it wasn't as easy as what people think, and I've been ridiculed for it, but I can't help it. You know, that's just the way things worked out.
You know, I saw it was inevitable that the skeptics, these debunker folks, would come after you to try to disprove your story. They found some, well, the witnesses who were over at the crossing, you know, some sort of an sentry point, they didn't see anything, and they found some problem in Charlie's background and tried to use that as a reason why it can't be true. You're telling us this. I mean, this book reads like it's true. There's a lot of evidence and other witnesses who say it's true, and you sound like you're telling it truthfully. It is the truth, right?
I tried to be just as honest as what I could in the book, and I tell people, if you don't believe it, buy the book. We got it backed up with all kind of things that will stand up in a court of law if it went to a court of law. To be honest, and you know, there's polygraph tests, there's voice stress tests, there's hypnosis, there's eyewitnesses, and just keeps going on. This hip, where you hypnotize, buy the book, leave yourself an open mind, because if you don't believe it after you read the book, believe that something did happen, you'll never believe it anyway. And I'll be honest with you, I don't care if people believe it or not. It's just one of them things where they want to believe it, they can. They don't have to. So I'm going to tell it the way that it is. If people want to believe it, fine. If you don't want to believe it, then good. I'm not going to sit up there and let them talk a bunch of trash about me or Charlie or nobody else. But, you know, because I don't believe in that. I don't get into politics.
Yeah. We started our conversation with you saying, you know, you wish you'd come forward before. I mean, your wife gave you a lot of support about writing this book and telling the story, right?
She did. She was one of the biggest reasons, because I've never sat down to talk to her about it. You could tell she wanted to ask something, and then when I sat down, was going to try to tell her one time, and she got real nervous and shook up, and she can't even read the book now. But she felt like I owed it to the people, especially here in Jackson County and on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, that I kind of owed it to the people to tell them, because everywhere we go, somebody asked me about it. Or we have people showing up at our house uninvited and just barge in. We had a guy from the Associated Press one day come up. We had company from Seattle, Washington here, and he just barged his way in for an interview. Now, how the hell these people find you, I don't know. And what I should have done was give him a good interview. I should have took him out and strangled him.
And, don't do that, Calvin. Calvin Parker, it's been a pleasure. I hope that if you ever get into the area around Las Vegas, you'd let me know about it. I'll take you and your wife to dinner, and I really enjoyed our conversation, and I enjoyed the book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope we run into each other on the trail. Thanks again. Thanks to my earlier guests, Ray Hernandez and Rudy Shield, about their book, Beyond UFOs, The Science of Consciousness, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, webmaster Greg Bishop, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. Good night, everyone.